It could, however, opt to make some regulation respecting the introduction of them, slaves, in the new states to be formed out of the Western Territory, a matter he thought well worthy of consideration. On the all-important question of the implicit understanding about the future of slavery itself, whether it was presumed to be on the road to extinction or forever protected where it already existed, Madison did not comment. Given the sharp sectional divisions in the debate, the vote to refer the petitions to a committee was surprisingly one-sided, 43-11. 7 of the negative votes came from South Carolina and Georgia. Nor was anyone from either of those two states willing to serve on the committee, which was instructed to report its findings to the full House before the end of the session. Thus ended, at least for the time being, the fullest public exchange of views on the most deep-rooted problem facing the new American republic. Hindsight permits us to listen to the debate of 1790 with knowledge that none of the participants possessed, for we know full well what they could perceive dimly, if at all, namely, that slavery would become the central and defining problem for the next 70 years of American history, that the inability to take decisive action against slavery in the decades immediately following the Revolution permitted the size of the enslaved population to grow exponentially, and the legal and political institutions of the developing U.S. government to become entwined in compromises with slavery's persistence, and that eventually over 600,000 Americans would die in the nation's bloodiest war to resolve the crisis, a trauma generating social shockwaves that would reverberate for at least another century. What is familiar history for us, however, was still the unknown future for them. And while the debate of 1790 reveals that they were profoundly interested in what the future would bring, their arguments were rooted in the past they knew best, which is to say, the recent experience of the successful revolutionary struggle against Great Britain, and the even more recent creation of a federal government uniting the 13 states into a more cohesive nation. The core of the disagreement in the debate of 1790 revolved around different versions of what has come to be called America's original intentions, more specifically, what the Revolution meant for the institution of slavery. One's answer, it turned out, depended a great deal on which founding moment, 1776 or 1787, seemed most seminal, and it depended almost entirely on the geographic and demographic location of the person posing the question. At least at the rhetorical level, the egalitarian principles on which the American revolutionaries had based their war for independence from Great Britain placed slavery on the permanent defensive and gave what seemed at the time a decisive advantage to the anti-slavery side of any debate. Jefferson's initial draft of the Declaration of Independence had included language that described the slave trade as the perverse plot of an evil English monarch designed to contaminate innocent colonists. Though the passage was deleted by the Continental Congress in the final draft, it nevertheless captured the nearly rhapsodic sense that the American Revolution was both a triumphant and transformative moment in world history when all laws and human relationships dependent on coercion would be swept away forever. And however utopian and excessive the natural rights section of the Declaration, we hold these truths to be self-evident, might appear later on, in the crucible of the revolutionary moment, it gave lyrical expression to a widespread belief that a general emancipation of slaves was both imminent and inevitable, the natural consequence and fitting capstone of a glorious liberation from medieval mores historically associated with the very British government that Americans were rejecting. If the Bible were a somewhat contradictory source when it came to the question of slavery, the Declaration of Independence, the secular version of American scripture, was an unambiguous tract for abolition. In the long run, as we know, the liberal values of the Declaration did indeed win out. But we also need to recognize that in the short run, during and immediately after the War for Independence, there was a prevailing consensus that slavery was already on the road to extinction. In 1776, for example, when the Continental Congress voted to repeal the Non-Importation Agreement of 1774, it chose to retain its prohibition against the importation of African slaves, a clear statement of opposition to the resumption of the slave trade. The manpower needs created by the Six-Year War generated several emancipation schemes, whereby slaves would be freed and their owners compensated in return for enlistment for the duration of the conflict. Though this was really an emergency proposal dictated by the military crisis and was ultimately rejected by the planter class in South Carolina and Georgia, its very suggestion seemed prophetic. Toward the end of the war, Lafayette, that paragon of the Franco-American alliance, who was always eager to join the parade when history was on the march, urged Washington to declare a general emancipation for all slaves in Virginia and resettle them in the western region of the state as tenant farmers. But these were merely inspirational episodes that never quite lived up to their promise. The most tangible and enduring anti-slavery effects of the revolutionary mentality occurred in the northern states during and immediately after the war. Vermont, 1777, and New Hampshire, 1779, made slavery illegal in their state constitutions. Massachusetts declared it unconstitutional in a state Supreme Court decision, 1783. Pennsylvania, 1780, and Rhode Island, 1784, passed laws ending it immediately within their borders. Connecticut, 1784, followed suit with a gradual emancipation plan. New York and New Jersey, which contained the largest slave populations north of the Chesapeake, proved more recalcitrant for that very reason. But despite the defeat there of several gradual emancipation schemes in the 1780s, defenders of slavery in the northern states were clearly fighting a losing battle. Abolition in the north was more a question of when than whether. Nor was this all. In 1782, the Virginia legislature passed a law permitting slave owners to free their slaves at their own discretion. By the end of the decade, there were over 12,000 freedmen in the state. At the same time, Thomas Jefferson was writing Notes on the State of Virginia, the only book he ever published, in which he sketched out a plan whereby all slaves born after 1800 would eventually become free. In 1784, Jefferson also proposed a bill in the federal Congress prohibiting slavery in all the western territories. It failed to pass by a single vote. One did not need to be a hopeless visionary to conjure up a mental picture of the American Revolution as a dramatic explosion that had destroyed the very foundation on which slavery rested and then radiated out its emancipatory energies with irresistible force. The slave trade was generally recognized as a criminal activity. Slavery was dead or dying throughout the northern states. The expansion of the institution into the West looked uncertain. Virginia appeared to be the beachhead for an anti-slavery impulse destined to sweep through the South. The time seemed ripe to reconcile America's Republican rhetoric with a new post-revolutionary reality. This uplifting vision, it turned out, was mostly a mirage. In fact, the very presumptiveness of the revolutionary rhetoric served to obfuscate the quite palpable reality that slavery, no matter how anomalous in purely ideological terms, was still deeply embedded in the very structure of American society at multiple levels or layers that remained impervious to wishful thinking and revolutionary expectations. the passionate conviction that the revolution was like a mighty wave fated to sweep slavery off the American landscape actually created false optimism and fostered a misguided sense of inevitability that rendered human action or agency superfluous. Why bother with specific schemes when history would soon arrive with all the answers? Moreover, one of the reasons the revolution proved so successful as a movement for independence was that its immediate and short-run goals were primarily political, removing royal governors and rewriting state constitutions that, in fact, already embodied many of the republican features the revolution now sanctioned. Removing slavery, however, was not like removing British officials or revising constitutions. In isolated pockets of New York and New Jersey, and more panoramically in the entire region south of the Potomac, slavery was woven into the fabric of American society in ways that defied appeals to logic or morality. It also enjoyed the protection of one of the revolution's most potent legacies, the right to dispose of one's property without arbitrary interference from others, especially when the others resided far away or claimed the authority of some distant government. There were, to be sure, radical implications latent in the principles of 76 capable of challenging privileged appeals to property rights, but the secret of their success lay in their latency, that is, the gradual and surreptitious ways they revealed their egalitarian implications over the course of the 19th century. If slavery's cancerous growth was to be arrested and the dangerous malignancy removed, it demanded immediate surgery. The radical implications of the revolutionary legacy were no help at all so long as they remained only implications. The depth and apparent intractability of the problem became much clearer during the debates surrounding the drafting and ratification of the Constitution. Although the final draft of the document was conspicuously silent on slavery, the subject itself haunted the closed-door debates. No less a source than Madison believed that slavery was the central cause of the most elemental division in the Constitutional Convention. The states were divided into different interests not by their difference of size, Madison observed, but principally from their having or not having slaves. It did not lie between the large and small states. It lay between the northern and southern. The delegates from New England and most of the Middle Atlantic states drew directly on the inspirational rhetoric of the revolutionary legacy to argue that slavery was inherently incompatible with the republican values on which the American Revolution had been based. They wanted an immediate end to the slave trade, an explicit statement prohibiting the expansion of slavery into the Western territories as a condition for admission into the Union, and the adoption of a national plan for gradual emancipation analogous to those state plans already adopted in the North. The most forceful expression of the Northern position on the slave trade came, somewhat ironically, from Luther Martin of Maryland, who denounced it as an odious bargain with sin that was inconsistent with the principles of the Revolution and dishonorable to the American character. The fullest expression of the Northern position on abolition itself came from Governor Morris, a New Yorker but serving as a delegate from Pennsylvania, who described slavery as a curse that actually retarded the economic development of the South and the most prominent feature in the aristocratic countenance of the proposed Constitution. Morris even proposed a national tax to compensate the slave owners, claiming that he would much prefer a tax for paying for all the Negroes in the United States than saddle posterity with such a constitution. In the speeches of Martin and Morris, one can discern the clearest articulation of the view, later embraced by the leadership of the abolitionist movement, that slavery was a non-negotiable issue, that this was the appropriate and propitious moment to place it on the road to ultimate extinction, and that any compromise of that long-term goal was a covenant with death. The southern position might more accurately be described as deep southern, since it did not include Virginia. Its major advocates were South Carolina and Georgia, and the chief burden for making the case in the Constitutional Convention fell almost entirely on the South Carolina delegation. The underlying assumption of this position was most openly acknowledged by Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina, namely that South Carolina and Georgia cannot do without slaves. What those from the Deep South wanted was open-ended access to African imports to stock their plantations. They also wanted equivalently open access to Western lands, meaning no federal restrictions on slavery in the territories. Finally, they wanted a specific provision in the Constitution that would prohibit any federal legislation restricting the property rights of slave owners, in effect, a constitutional assurance that slavery, as it existed in the Deep South, would be permitted to flourish. The clearest statement of their concerns came from Pierce Butler and John Rutledge of South Carolina. Butler explained that the security the southern states want is that their Negroes may not be taken from them. Rutledge added that the people of those states will never be such fools as to give up so important an interest. The implicit but unmistakably clear message underlying their position, which later became the trump card played by the next generation of South Carolinians in the nullification crisis in 1832, then more defiantly by the secessionists in 1861, was the threat to leave the Union if the federal government ever attempted to implement a national emancipation policy. Neither side got what it wanted at Philadelphia in 1787. The Constitution contained no provision that committed the newly created federal government to a policy of gradual emancipation, or in any clear sense placed slavery on the road to ultimate extinction. On the other hand, the Constitution contained no provisions that specifically sanctioned slavery as a permanent and protected institution south of the Potomac or anywhere else. The distinguishing feature of the document when it came to slavery was its evasiveness. It was neither a contract with abolition nor a covenant with death, but rather a prudent exercise in ambiguity. The circumlocutions required to place a chronological limit on the slave trade or to count slaves as 3/5 of a person for purposes of representation in the House, all without ever using the forbidden word, capture the intentionally elusive ethos of the Constitution. The underlying reason for this calculated orchestration of non-commitment was obvious. Any clear resolution of the slavery question, one way or the other, rendered ratification of the Constitution virtually impossible. Two specific compromises illustrate the tendency to fashion political bargains on slavery that simultaneously disguised the deep moral division within the convention and framed the compromise solution in terms that permitted each side to claim victory. The first enigmatic bargain concerned the expansion of slavery into the West, and actually occurred in the Confederation Congress that was also meeting in Philadelphia. One of the last and most consequential acts of the Congress was to pass the Northwest Ordinance in July of 1787. Article 6 of the Ordinance forbade slavery in the territory north of the Ohio River, a decision that could plausibly be interpreted as the first step toward a more general exclusion of slavery in all incoming states, the Jefferson Proposal of 1784. On the other hand, the ordinance could also be read as a tacit endorsement of slavery in the southwestern region, which eventually proved to be the case. In any event, The passage of the Northwest Ordinance was a blessed event for the delegates at the Constitutional Convention, in part because it removed a potentially divisive issue from their agenda, and in part because the solution it posed could be heard to speak with both a northern and southern accent. The second bargain can, with considerable justice, be described as the most important compromise reached at the Constitutional Convention, even more so than the great compromise between large and small states over representation in the Senate and House. It might more accurately be called the sectional compromise. No less an authority than Madison considered it the most consequential of all the secret deals made in Philadelphia. An understanding on the two subjects of navigation and slavery, Madison explained, had taken place between those parts of the Union. The bargain entailed an exchange of votes, whereby New England agreed to back an extension of the slave trade for 20 years, in return for support from the Deep South for making the federal regulation of commerce a mere majority vote in Congress rather than a supermajority of 2/3. As with the Northwest Ordinance, both sides could declare victory, and the true victors would only become known with the passage of time. John C. Calhoun would subsequently conclude that if the Deep South had regarded this bargain as a wager on the future, it was a losing bet. The debates in the ratifying conventions of the respective states only exposed the irreconcilable differences of opinion that the Constitution had so deftly bundled together. In Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, for example, opponents of the Constitution objected to the implicit acceptance of slavery's persistence, represented by the 3/5 clause and the 20-year extension of the slave trade. Supporters assured them, however, that these partial and limited concessions only reflected the fading gasps of a dying institution. James Wilson of Pennsylvania predicted that emancipation was inevitable, and though the period is more distant than I could wish, yet it will produce the same kind of gradual change for the whole nation as was pursued in Pennsylvania. As for the Western territories, Wilson was certain that Congress would never allow slaves in any of the new states. Luther Martin, on the other hand, came out against the Constitution on the grounds that the protections afforded slavery render us contemptible to every true friend of liberty in the world. Martin was perhaps the first public advocate of the covenant with death interpretation of the Constitution, as well as the first former delegate to denounce the sectional compromise as a corrupt bargain. But in a close vote, his Maryland colleagues rejected his reading of the document as excessively pessimistic. Meanwhile, down in South Carolina, the assurances afforded slavery that so troubled Martin of Maryland struck many delegates as inadequate. Charles Cotesworth Pinckney helped win the day for ratification with his own gloss on the true meaning of the compact. "We have a security that the general government can never emancipate them, for no such authority is granted, and it is admitted on all hands that the general government has no powers but which are expressly granted by the Constitution, and that all rights not expressed were reserved by the several states. In short, considering all circumstances, we have made the best terms for the security of this species of property it was in our power to make. We would have made better if we could, but on the whole, I do not think them bad." The fullest and most intellectually interesting debate occurred in Virginia. As the most populous state, with both the largest slave population, 292,000, and the largest free black population, 12,000, Virginia's demographic profile looked decidedly southern. Only South Carolina had a higher density of blacks, 60% to Virginia's 40%, but Virginia's rhetorical posture sounded distinctly northern, or, perhaps more accurately, The political leadership of the Old Dominion relished its role as the chief spokesman for the principles of 76, which placed slavery under a permanent shadow and seemed to align Virginia against the Deep South. Jefferson, it must be remembered, had proposed the abolition of slavery in all the Western territories. Madison, though he eventually endorsed the Three-Fifths Clause, acknowledged his discomfort with the doctrine, confessing that it may appear to be a little strained in some points. Most significantly, the Virginians were adamantly opposed to the continuation of the slave trade. Both Madison and his colleague George Mason denounced the sectional compromise in the Constitutional Convention that prolonged the trade, and Mason eventually voted against ratification in part for that very reason. On the surface, at least, Virginia seemed the one southern state where the ideological contagion of the American Revolution remained sufficiently potent to dissolve the legacy of slavery. Upon closer examination, however, Virginia turned out to resemble the fuzzier and more equivocal picture that best describes the nation at large and that the Constitution was designed to mirror. For beneath their apparent commitment to anti-slavery and their accustomed place in the vanguard of revolutionary principles, the Virginians were overwhelmingly opposed to relinquishing one iota of control over their own slave population to any federal authority. Whether they were living a paradox or a lie is an interesting question. What is undeniably clear is that the Virginia leadership found itself in the peculiar position of acknowledging that slavery was an evil and then proceeding to insist that there was nothing the federal government could do about it. Mason's vehement opposition to the slave trade rested cheek by jowl with his demand for a constitutional guarantee to protect what he described as the property of that kind which we have already. Virginia's true position was less principled than it looked. Its plantations were already stocked with slaves, so opposition to the slave trade made economic sense, as did opposition to emancipation. Mason thought that the Constitution had it exactly wrong. They have done what they ought not to have done, that is, extended the life of the slave trade, and have left undone what they ought to have done, that is, explicitly prohibited federal interference in what he called our domestic interests. Edmund Randolph made it abundantly clear at the Virginia Ratifying Convention just what domestic interests Mason had in mind. Randolph, in his own roundabout way, had come over to support ratification, so he needed to counter Mason's apprehensions about slavery. "I might tell you," he apprised his Virginia colleagues, "that the southern states, even South Carolina herself, conceived this property to be secure, and that except for Mason, not a member of the Virginia delegation had the smallest suspicion of the abolition of slavery." Virginia, in short, talked Northern, but thought Southern. If one wished to generalize, then, about the situation that obtained in 1790 at the moment of the congressional debate over the Quaker petitions, the one thing that seemed clear concerning slavery was that nothing was clear at all. The initial debate in February had, in fact, accurately reflected the competing and incompatible presumptions about slavery's fate in the American Republic, with one side emphasizing the promissory note to end it purportedly issued in 1776, the other side emphasizing the gentleman's agreement to permit it reached in 1787, and a middle group dominated by the Virginians straddling both sides and counseling moderation lest the disagreement produced a sectional rupture. Both sides could plausibly claim a core strand of the revolutionary legacy as their own, and all parties to the debate seemed to believe that history as well as the future was on their side. Like a lightning flash in the night, the initial exchange on the floor of Congress in February of 1790 had exposed these divisions of opinion before a national audience for the first time. On March 8th, the committee was prepared to submit its report, thereby assuring that the controversy would not go away or get buried in some parliamentary graveyard. Representatives from the Deep South rose to express their outrage that the forbidden subject was again being allowed into public view. William Loudon Smith pointed up to the anti-slavery advocates who had stacked the galleries, like evil spirits hovering over our heads. James Jackson actually made menacing faces at the Quakers in the gallery, called them outright lunatics, then launched into a tirade so emotional and incoherent that reporters in the audience had difficulty recording his words. The gist seemed to be that any decision to receive the committee report was tantamount to the dissolution of the Union. These threatening harangues managed to delay matters, but the Deep South lacked the votes. On March 16th, the committee was ready to make its report to the House. First Jackson and then Smith were also prepared with their response, which turned out to be the fullest public exposition of the pro-slavery position yet presented in the United States. In fact, virtually every argument that Southern defenders of slavery would mount during the next 70 years of national controversy right up to the eve of the Civil War came gushing forth over the next 2 days. Jackson spoke first and held the floor for about 2 hours. He could not believe that a dignified body of sober-minded legislators were allowing these shaking Quakers with their throbbing consciences to control the national agenda. One of the petitioners, an infamous do-gooder of uncertain sanity named Warner Mifflin, had actually acknowledged that his anti-slavery vision had come to him after he was struck by lightning in a thunderstorm. The Congress had been elected to steer the ship of state through rough and uncharted waters, not to take aboard a crew of dazed dreamers bent on sailing to the promised land, but inadvertently destined to sink the ship on its maiden voyage. Speaking of promises, a sacred compact had been made when the nation was founded in 1787. A compact which brought us together mutually to relinquish a share of our interests to preserve the remainder. Then Jackson described the sectional compromise at the Constitutional Convention, whereby the Southern states for this very principle gave into what might be termed the navigation law of the Eastern and Western states, a concession granted in return for retention of the slave trade for 20 years. The Quaker petitioners were now asking the Congress to break that compact and thereby violate the understanding on which the states of the Deep South had entered the Union. Moreover, there was an even more elemental understanding implicitly codified in Philadelphia, but actually predating the Constitutional Convention by many years. It was rooted in the realistic recognition that slavery had been grafted onto the character of the Southern states during the colonial era and had become a permanent part of American society south of the Potomac. If it were a crime, as some assert, but which I deny, Jackson explained, the British nation is answerable for it and not the present inhabitants who now hold that species of property in question. Northern posturing on this matter was insufferable, as Jackson saw it, since their oozing arguments transformed a geographic accident and a product of historical circumstance into a willful sin. The incontrovertible truth was that slavery was one of those habits established long before the Constitution and could not now be remedied. When the 13 colonies rebelled against Britain, no one raised this question, and when the nation was formed into a more unified whole in 1787, the Union had received them with all the ill habits about them. The implicit but thoroughly understood sectional agreement, which the sectional compromise at Philadelphia merely underlined, was that slavery, while anomalous within the framework of Republican ideology, was a self-evident reality that had been allowed to coexist alongside Jefferson's self-evident truths. The custom, the habit of slavery is established, Jackson observed, and all responsible American statesmen had agreed that the Southern states must be left to themselves on this subject. Anti-slavery idealists might prefer to live in some better world, which, like all such places, was too good to be true. The American nation in 1790, however, was a real world, laden with legacies like slavery, and therefore too true to be good. Jackson did not go so far as to argue, as did Southern apologists two or three generations later, that slavery was a positive good. But he did insist in non-negotiable language that it was a necessary evil. Jackson had several books at his side, and he began to read to his colleagues in order to demonstrate that his opinions were shared by the most respected authorities. The most respected authority of all, the Christian God in the Bible, sanctioned slavery in several passages from the Old Testament. In addition, the most reliable and recent studies of African tribal culture demonstrated that slavery was a long-standing custom among the Africans themselves. So enslaved Africans in America were simply experiencing a condition here that they would otherwise experience, probably in more oppressive fashion, in their mother country. Then Jackson referred his colleagues to the opinions of Mr. Jefferson, our Secretary of State, and began reading from Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia on the practical question, what is to be done with the slaves when freed? Either they must be incorporated where they are, or they must be colonized somewhere else. Jefferson's view of the question was so well known that Jackson claimed he could quote from Jefferson's book from memory. The two races cannot live together on equal terms because of deep-rooted prejudices entertained by the whites, 10,000 recollections by the blacks of the injuries they have sustained, new provocations, the real distinctions that nature has made, and many other circumstances which divide us into parties and produce convulsions which would never end but with the extermination of one or the other race. Perhaps there were a few whites in the North who did not concur with Mr. Jefferson's sentiments. Perhaps the Quaker petitioners approved of racial mixing and looked forward to giving their daughters to Negro sons, and receiving the Negro daughters for their sons. But despite the relatively small size of the black population in the North, the pattern of racial segregation there suggested that most Northern whites shared Jefferson's belief that incorporation was unlikely. In the South, where the number of blacks was so much larger, it was unthinkable. Those advocating emancipation, then, need to confront the intractable dilemma posed by the sheer size of an African population that, once freed, must be removed to some other location. Apart from the obvious question of cost, which would prove astronomically high, where could the freed blacks be sent? Those advocating an African solution might profitably study the recent English efforts to establish a black colony in Sierra Leone, where most of the freed blacks died or were enslaved by the local African tribes. Those advocating a location in the American West also needed to think again. The peoples of America, like an overwhelming torrent, are rapidly covering the earth and extending their settlements throughout this vast continent, nor is there any spot, however remote, but a short period will settle. Moreover, vast tracts in the West had already been promised to the Indians, whose response to a population of black neighbors was likely to prove uncharitable in the extreme. If anyone had a responsible solution to this problem, Jackson claimed to be receptive. But until such a solution materialized, all talk of emancipation must cease. No one from outside the Deep South rose to answer Jackson. The next day, March 17th, William Loudon Smith held the floor for over 2 hours without interruption and repeated most of Jackson's points. Whereas Jackson tended toward a more volatile and pulpit-thumping style reminiscent of an itinerant Presbyterian minister in the revivalistic mode, Smith preferred the more measured cadences of the South Carolina aristocrat steeped in Ciceronian formalities. But despite the stylistic differences, the arguments were identical. The Constitution was absolutely clear that the slave trade could not be ended before 1808. There was a sectional compact that recognized slavery's existence where it was already rooted south of the Potomac. Any attempts to renegotiate that compact would mean the dissolution of the Union. The demographic and racial realities rendered any emancipation scheme impossible, most especially for white Southerners who lived amid a sizable black population. Smith also quoted from Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, then put his own cast on the racial implications of a large free black population in America. If the blacks did not intermarry with the whites, they would remain black until the end of time, for it was not contended that liberating them would whitewash them. If they did intermarry with the whites, then the white race would be extinct, and the American people would all be of the mulatto breed. In whatever light, therefore, the subject was viewed, the folly of emancipation was manifest. The full pro-slavery argument was now out in the open. If one looked forward from this dramatic moment, the speeches by Jackson and Smith became prophetic previews of coming attractions for the Southern defense of slavery in the 19th century, a defense that would eventually lose on the battlefields of the Civil War. If one looked backward, nothing quite so defiant or systematic had ever been presented before. True enough, the constitutional arguments represented a consolidation of points made in Philadelphia in 1787 and then in several state ratifying conventions. But the brazen claim that slavery must be accepted unconditionally as a permanent feature of the National Confederation was, if not wholly new, at least an interpretive clarification never before made in a national forum. And the racial argument, which added the specter of a racially mixed American society as a consequence of emancipation, gave a new dimension to the debate by attempting to transform the sectional disagreement between North and South into a national alliance of whites against blacks. The novelty of the arguments now pouring forth from the representatives of the Deep South must also be understood in context. The particulars were new, but the attitudes on which they rested were familiar. No responsible statesman in the Revolutionary era had ever contemplated, much less endorsed, a biracial American society. In 1776, for example, when the Continental Congress had commissioned John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson to design a seal for the United States, they produced a national emblem depicting Americans of English, Scottish, Irish, French, German, and Dutch extraction. There were no Africans or Native Americans in the picture. The new pro-slavery argument, then, drew on assumptions about the white Anglo-Saxon character of the emerging American nation that were latent but long-standing. No explicit articulation of those assumptions had been necessary in a national forum before 1790, because no frontal assault on slavery had been made that required a direct or systematic response. Those historians who claim that a distinctive racial ideology first came into existence at this time, describing it as a fresh construction or invention designed to frame the debate over slavery in a more effectively prejudicial way, have a point, or perhaps half a point, in the sense that the challenge to slavery drove the racial and racist presumptions to the surface of the debate for the first time. But they had been lurking in the hearts and minds of the revolutionary generation all along. The ultimate legacy of the American Revolution on slavery was not an implicit compact that it be ended, or a gentleman's agreement between the two sections that it be tolerated, but rather a calculated obviousness that it not be talked about at all. Slavery was the unmentionable family secret, or the proverbial elephant in the middle of the room. What was truly new in the pro-slavery argument was not really the ideas or attitudes expressed, but the expression itself. There was yet another new ingredient about to enter the debate in 1790, though it too was more a matter of making visible and self-conscious what had previously hovered in some twilight zone of hazy and unspoken recognition. Perhaps the least controversial decision of the first Congress was passage of legislation that authorized the census of 1790, an essential item because accurate population figures were necessary to determine the size of state delegations in the House. The following information was being gathered quite literally while the debate over the Quaker petitions raged. 1790 Census of the United States. Vermont, 85,268 free white, 255 all other free persons, 16 slaves, total 85,539. New Hampshire, 141,097 free white, 630 all other free persons, 158 slaves, total 141,885. Maine, 96,002 free white, 538 all other free persons, no slaves, total 96,540. Massachusetts, 373,324 free white, 5,463 all other free persons, no slaves, total 378,787. Rhode Island, 64,470 free white, 3,407 all other free persons, 948 slaves, total 68,825. Connecticut, 232,674 free white, 2,808 all other free persons, 2,764 slaves, total 237,946. New York, 314,142 free white, 4,654 all other free persons, 21,324 slaves, total 340,120. New Jersey, 169,954 free white, 2,762 all other free persons, 11,423 slaves, total 184,139. Pennsylvania, 424,099 free white, 6,537 all other free persons, 3,737 slaves, total 434,373. Delaware, 46,310 free white, 3,899 all other free persons, 8,887 slaves, total 59,094. Maryland, 208,649 free white, 8,043 all other free persons, 103,036 slaves, total 319,728. Virginia, 442,117 free white, 12,866 all other free persons, 292,627 slaves, total 747,610. Kentucky, 61,133 free white, 114 all other free persons, 12,430 slaves, total 73,677. North Carolina, 288,204 free white, 4,975 all other free persons, 100,572 slaves, total 393,751. South Carolina, 140,178 free white, 1,801 all other free persons, 107,094 slaves, total 249,073. Georgia, 52,886 free white, 398 all other free persons, 29,264 slaves, total 82,548. The totals for all the states were 3,140,205 free white, 59,150 all other free persons, 694,280 slaves, total 3,893,635. At the most obvious level, these numbers confirmed with enhanced precision the self-evident reality that slavery was a sectional phenomenon that was dying out in the North and flourishing in the South. The exceptions were New York and New Jersey, which not incidentally remained the only northern states to resist the passage of gradual emancipation laws. In general, then, there was a direct and nearly perfect correlation between demography and ideology, that is, between the ratio of blacks to whites in the population and the reluctance to consider abolition. When the pro-slavery advocates of the Deep South unveiled their racial argument, what will happen between the races after emancipation, the census of 1790 allowed one to predict the response with near precision. Wherever the black population reached a threshold level, slavery remained the preferred means of assuring the segregation of the races. The only possible exception to this rule was the Upper South, to include the states of Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina. There, the slave populations were large, in Virginia very large indeed, but so were the populations of free blacks, all other free persons. From a strictly demographic perspective, Virginia was almost as vulnerable to the specter of post-emancipation racial fears as South Carolina. But the growing size of the free black population accurately reflected the presence of multiple schemes for gradual emancipation within the planter class and the willingness of at least a few slave owners to act in accord with the undeniable logic of the American Revolution. The sheer size of Virginia's total population, amplified by the daunting racial ratio, and then further amplified by the political prowess of its leadership at the national level, all combined to make it the key state. If any national plan for ending slavery was to succeed, Virginia needed to be in the vanguard. Finally, the census of 1790 provided unmistakable evidence that those anti-slavery advocates who believed that the future was on their side were deluding themselves. for the total slave population was now approaching 700,000, up from about 500,000 in the year of the Declaration of Independence. Despite the temporary end of the slave trade during the war, and despite the steady march of abolition in the North, the slave population in the South was growing exponentially at the same exploding rate as the American population as a whole, which meant it was doubling every 20 to 25 years. Given the political realities that defined the parameters of any comprehensive program for emancipation, namely compensation for owners, relocation of freed slaves, and implementation over a sufficient time span to permit economic and social adjustments, the larger the enslaved population grew, the more financially and politically impractical any emancipation scheme became. One interpretation of the Deep South's argument of 1790 was that, at least from their perspective, the numbers already made such a decision impossible. The census of 1790 revealed that the window of opportunity to end slavery was not opening, but closing. For not only were the numbers becoming wholly unmanageable, but the further one got from 1776, the lower the revolutionary fires burned, and the less imperative the logic of the revolutionary ideology seemed. What one historian has called the perishability of revolutionary time meant that the political will to act was also racing against the clock. In effect, the fading revolutionary ideology and the growing racial demography were converging to close off the political options. With all the advantage of hindsight, a persuasive case can be made that the Quaker petitioners were calling for decisive action against slavery at the last possible moment, if indeed there was such a moment, when gradual emancipation had any meaningful prospect for success. The chief strength of the pro-slavery argument that emerged from the Deep South delegation in the congressional debate of March 16th to 17th was its relentless focus on the impractical dimensions of all plans for abolition. In effect, their arguments exposed the two major weaknesses of the anti-slavery side. First, those ardent ideologues who believed that slavery would die a natural death after the Revolution were naive utopians proven wrong by the stubborn realities reflected in the census of 1790. Second, the gradual emancipation plans implemented in the northern states were inoperative models for the nation as a whole, because the northern states contained only about 10% of the slave population. For all those states from Maryland south, the cost of compensation and the logistical difficulties attendant upon the relocation of the freed slaves were simply insurmountable. The numbers, quite simply, did not work. How correct were these conclusions? From a strictly historical perspective, we can never know the answer to that question. Since no one from the North or the Upper South rose to answer the delegation from the Deep South, and since no national plan for gradual emancipation ever came before the Congress for serious consideration, we are left with a great silence, which itself becomes the principal piece of historical evidence to interpret. And the two overlapping interpretations that then present themselves with irresistible logic are quite clear. First, the arguments of the Deep South were unanswerable because there was sufficient truth in the fatalistic diagnosis to persuade other members of the House that the slavery problem was intractable. And second, whatever shred of possibility still existed to take concerted action against slavery was overwhelmed by the secessionist threat from South Carolina and Georgia, since there could be no national solution to the slavery problem if there were no nation at hand to implement a solution. Perhaps, as some historians have argued, South Carolina and Georgia were bluffing. But the most salient historical fact cannot be avoided. No one stepped forward to call their bluff. Though we might wish otherwise, the history of what might have been is usually not really history at all, mixing together as it does the messy tangle of past experience with the clairvoyant certainty of our present preferences. That said, even though no formal proposal for a gradual emancipation program came before the Congress in 1790, all the elements for such a program were present in the debates. Moreover, in March of 1790, while the congressional debate was raging, a prominent Virginian by the name of Fernando Fairfax drafted a plan for liberating the Negroes within the United States, which was subsequently published in Philadelphia the following December. Fairfax's plan fleshed out the sketchy outline that Jefferson had provided in Notes on the State of Virginia. Another Virginian, St. George Tucker, developed an even fuller version of the same scheme 6 years later. In short, the historical record itself, and not just our own omniscient imaginations, provides the requisite evidence from which we can reconstruct the response to the pro-slavery argument. In so doing, we are not just engaging in wishful thinking, are not attempting to rewrite history along more attractive lines, but rather trying to assess the historical viability of a national emancipation policy in 1790. What chance, if any, existed at that propitious moment to put slavery on the road to extinction? All the plans for gradual emancipation assumed that slavery was a moral and economic problem that demanded a political solution. All also assumed that the solution needed to combine speed and slowness, meaning that the plan needed to be put into action quickly before the burgeoning slave population rendered it irrelevant, but implemented gradually so the costs could be absorbed more easily. Everyone advocating gradual emancipation also made two additional assumptions. First, that slave owners would be compensated, the funds coming from some combination of a national tax and from revenues generated by the sale of Western lands. Second, that the bulk of the freed slaves would be transported elsewhere, the Fairfax plan favoring an American colony in Africa on the British model of Sierra Leone, others proposing what might be called a homelands location in some unspecified region of the American West, and still others preferring a Caribbean destination. As we have seen, the projected cost of compensation was a potent argument against gradual emancipation, and the argument has been echoed in most scholarly treatments of the topic ever since. Estimates vary according to the anticipated price for each freed slave, which ranges between $100 and $200. The higher figure produces a total cost of about $140 million to emancipate the entire slave population in 1790.